Welcome to the Crazy Wisdom Podcast. This podcast is for you if you have an insane drive to find the truth of things. It's not the good answers that we seek, but the good questions. I interview a range of different guests from many different fields, all with the intention to uncover the simple truths that are hidden in plain sight. Most people don't want to go there. I go there. My guests go there, and you benefit. Please let me know if you enjoy these episodes, and as always, subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to the podcast. Welcome to the Crazy Wisdom Podcast. My guest today is Albert Chun. He is a director of operations and is improving LLMs at Invisible Technologies. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. So good to be here.
What's the craziest thing you've learned about LLMs over the past week or two?
Oh, that's a great question. In the past week or two?
Or, you know, last month, doesn't really matter.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, I will say, I think, well, one, maybe even just the other day was when, or yesterday when Sora came out, I think that news was pretty remarkable. Just thinking about the implications of that, like being able to, just use your words to create something that you wouldn't normally be able to is pretty remarkable. I immediately thought about like how that would change every like student's assignment or project and like just how it would redefine and augment like so many different things. And then obviously around like content marketing, all of these things. And I would say the broader thing that I'm learning about LLMs and the other part is that like just how when, you know, as we're improving it on the back end is just how much work goes into making it the way that they are. It's pretty ridiculous. And how much more there is to go. Yeah.
And it's, I think that's the thing that, you know, we both know from Invisible is just that the amount of human labor, I think, took a lot of the researchers by surprise. And I think a lot of the researchers were like, oh, okay, well, this is all just code. This is all just statistics. This is going to be relatively easy to train. And then turned out you needed a huge, huge amount of human labor to just give the voice to the LLMs. And I'm curious about, you know, like how that works on the video side as well, and how, whether they still, large language models, I know that you know this, and maybe my listeners know this too, but large language models, like we needed a whole bunch of humans to train the AI in how to use the language correctly. But this video thing might be totally different. And this relates to something I've been doing. I've been teaching myself how to code using AI, and then I've been using coding implementations called Cursor. Cursor is a fork of VS Code Editor, which all the programmers love to use. And it allows you to generate code using AI within the coder thing. And so I've been teaching myself how to code. And then I saw Sora yesterday, and I see this generation of videos with complex physics, and I'm just like, ooh, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe like, cause I've been learning how to code thinking that it's still going to be necessary to learn how to architect a system together. But then I saw that and I was like, oh, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this is going to be able to code very quickly to the point where even architecting the system isn't necessary anymore. Like, yeah, the thing can generate the code, but maybe it'll also be able to generate the code and then push those Lego pieces together to actually like create fully functioning apps without any sort of thing except just saying, this is the app that I want. Here are the things that I need. What do you think about all that?
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, I do think that software engineering and coding, I think that's always going to be important. But I think how widely important it was back in the late 90s or early noughts, I think it is going to slowly shift more towards annotators and prompt engineers and how can you best train the model and work with that feedback. So it's actually really exciting. I was sharing this with some of our annotators this last week around just how, you know, what they're doing is the future. And because what we're also seeing is just how complex some of these tasks are becoming. And like, not everyone can do it. You have to like, yeah, not everyone makes it. And we're still in the early days, right? And so, yeah, I can only see it getting more complex. I can only see that skill becoming increasingly valuable. And I think that there are, our annotators of today are going to be like as highly prized as our engineers in the past. But candidly, you know, it is not as specialized, or, you know, I think like the data labelers are going to, it's a bit more commoditized, but yeah, I think there's, as with anything, there are going to be levels to it. And some of the folks who are the best at it or best at challenging the model to produce high signal data, those folks are going to command significant dollars in the future.
That's really interesting. You just gave me a point that I hadn't thought about, because what an AI trainer is doing is that they're challenging the model in sort of, because there's supervised learning, there's unsupervised learning. RLHF is part of supervised learning, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like challenging the model to create the best output. And what you said is basically there's a whole bunch of low-hanging fruit that's already been kind of taken already. And now it's more and more on the outskirts of like how to actually like specialize in training. If anybody's interested in getting into AI training, what are some things that you can share with them?
Well, that's a great question. So I would probably look at any foundational model. They all have their own like customer education platforms. So like my favorite one, oh, this is actually a really good one, is Cohere's LLM University. It's really high quality, takes you like step by step through the basics of LLMs, and then it kind of builds up to prompt engineering. And then I think if you're a developer, more of the developer mindset, and you want to look at it more technically, OpenAI has a really good developer platform for prompt engineering. Hmm. Yeah, that's where I'd go to.
That's cool. We just had a meetup on Wednesday at the AI Whisperers meetup here in Buenos Aires. One of the guys who joined, he had just taken a quick flight from Switzerland because he wanted to escape the cold. And so he came down to Buenos Aires and joined our meetup here. And he was starting his thesis on what was it? Yeah, he was trying to figure out how to give a whole video to the LLM and have the LLM kind of capture all of the video stuff, all the high points of the meetings and stuff. But he was doing it from a very technical thing. And I didn't understand quite what he was saying, but the way that he was stringing together prompts is really interesting. He was really surprised because it was a very manual process, even though he was trying to programmatically kind of test a whole bunch of different prompts. I still don't understand it, so I'm butchering this right now. But one of the things that he said was really interesting was that he was talking about how there's a genetic algorithms where you basically use the principles of evolution, where you have a prompt and then you test it with various different changes. It's almost like A/B testing, where you change one part of it and then do it again, and then change another part of it, and then doing it again. And then over time, it kind of does it. And then he was using that with AI. Have you heard about any of this stuff at all?
I'm not familiar with that specifically, but I think the framework generally makes sense to me around how they might see like which data is most impactful to improving the model. That that kind of A/B testing approach makes sense to me.
Mm, cool.
Yeah.
What have you learned philosophically speaking around the AI world the last few months? Like, what has it taught you about yourself?
That's a great question. I would say that it made me think a lot about what it means to be human. So like, is all of our human endeavor about knowledge?
Mm.
And I would say absolutely not. So for example, with AI models right now, you have to ask it questions and it needs to give you a certain response. The higher quality your question, the higher quality response. From my experience with life, is it actually requires an incredible amount of wisdom to ask the right questions. Like, it's kind of like we offered earlier. It is really difficult to challenge a model by asking, hey, with all of these different capabilities and constraints and all that, it's really difficult to get that high signal data or response. And so, yeah, I would say it's not about the questions you ask. Some of the best things in my life have come from people speaking into my life, whether I knew it or not, asking me questions that drove my thinking. And so there's that. And I would say another part is like, what else makes me human? Is it my programming? Is it my, like, is it my programming? And another part is, could I be reprogrammed? Right? So here's an example. We're all programmed from, let's say, from our families, from our cities, from our school, from our upbringing, right? And many would say, well, you go over and some of the best kinds of learning is unlearning. Or in other words, the best kind of, sometimes the best programming is when you reprogram. And the question is, like, who gets to reprogram you is kind of part of your adult life, right? So here's a one possibility is, like, you know, one paradigm is that a lot of us get programmed by our mothers and fathers. And as you, let's say, a common life instance where you might get married or something, you allow your spouse to reprogram you in some ways, or you allow your children to reprogram you even after that, right? And so it just made me think, like, in that way, it almost reminds me of an LLM in some ways. How could I train even myself to be reprogrammed? And then to kind of push it further is that, are we only our programming? Like, what is my gut instinct? What's my hormones? What's my nature saying? And I don't know if I quite see that part of it. So, okay, I have this cerebral thing that is allowing me to operate this high level, but man, I am commanding this very like instinctual animal, right? And it's like not that easy, right? Like, I know what to do, but I don't do what I want to do. Like, how the heck do you, like, that's a whole battle. That's a whole struggle, right? Like, I know how to be a millionaire, but damn it, I'm not yet, right? Yeah. Like, I know how to get this, but I can't quite get there. And the question is, can an LLM get me to do that? Can they address that part of me? That's is the thing that's lacking for me, a cerebral part. Is it just the wisdom part? Or is there actually this other part that is like, how do I address my own human behavior or disposition?
Yeah.
Those are just some things that, as I'm thinking about what we're doing here, like, it's just, it will not live up. All I know is AI, as far as I can tell, it will not live up to fulfilling all of our human potential and desires because it misses those key pieces.
Yes, beautiful. There's so much we can talk to about from there. I loved what you said about what makes me human. Is it my programming? There's, you know, our mothers and fathers, and then choosing who we get into relationships with and how we get reprogrammed. And that ties directly into what you're saying about the gut instinct and whether am I just my thoughts? Like, am I just my thoughts? Am I just this sort of verbal picture making thing that I identify with, or is there something else there? And I agree with you. I don't think AI can do that. AI is going to just basically completely own this linguistic world, the factual world, the propositional world. And it reminds me of this great series called Awakening from the Meaning Crisis by John Vervaeke, who was actually a professor at University of Toronto. And he was kind of in the mix in 2018 and 2019 inside this university, which actually is one of the best AI universities. A lot of people at Invisible, or not a lot of people, some of the people at Invisible come from this university. So this Awakening from the Meaning Crisis goes all throughout Western and Eastern philosophy to try to understand what have people said about wisdom for thousands of years. And then and I'm now watching it for the fourth or fifth time. I didn't understand what he talked about AI. But now, after working in Invisible for so long, then I basically understand what he was talking about AI. And he actually had some really great insights. But basically, it's going to own the factual and the propositional world of facts and language and own these things. And when I say own, it's just going to, like, if I have a question about, you know, what happened in China in 1603, it's going to know that better than any researcher that I could know. It'll know that. And, you know, it's not there yet, but once we start to train it more and more, it's going to know that. But then, as you're saying, like, is that what makes us human? Is it only the propositional kind of factual understanding of language that's human, or is there something deeper? And I think it's just, we're going to find out more and more and more about ourselves, that it's just much more deeper to be human being. And I guess that leads to the next question. Like, what is your take on creativity? And how will it, because particularly now with that Sora thing of just, we can now generate videos on the fly and they're really good and we can make beautiful stories and everything like that. Where, what is creativity and what happens to creativity in the world of AI?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, that's one that I candidly have not thought too much about in light of things like Sora. But I mean, there is a general idea that, hey, should AI take over some more mundane remote work, that this should free us up to be more creative? I think that's a pretty like commonly held belief, and I generally tend to agree with that. And I also think about the way that I think society swings in terms of the spectrum, right? Where we go from this, hey, let's reward like really clear binary business thinking to, hey, all of a sudden we're realizing, wow, like it's really important to lead with empathy and lead with like psychologically safe best practices. Like those are things that would be totally foreign previously, or like similar to me, right? Growing up, hey, I was lauded for my art skills from like a very early age. Hey, like you should go to art school, you should do that. And knowing deep down in my brain, hey, I will not make money that way. I am not going to do that. So, right. But now, yeah, like I could see in the future being, hey, that binary way of thinking that used to get you the reward, like it's taken care of. What is needed now is a creativity. And yeah, I mean, that I would love that. Like for my children, I would love it for them to be able to tap into their creativity to do that. I think the part that makes me worried or somewhat concerned, though, is discipline, right? I think there is discipline with creativity that is really difficult, right? Like my wife is an artist. I work with people who write and things like that, and it is so difficult to be disciplined, to put pen to paper every day, whether you feel like it or not. And how motivated are people going to be to do that when they have such an easy creativity tool at their fingertips? When I feel like some of the best ideas, some of the best things, they don't happen in the first or second time. It might happen in your 1,000th try, right? A few years in or a decade into your practice. And I feel like, you know, with creativity, with whatever, wherever we swing, like I'm still going to bank on the fact that whatever ends up being rewarded, you will be doubly or exponentially rewarded if it's coupled with discipline.
Yeah, and that's interesting because now we're entering a world and we've got this first generation who's grown up on technology in a way that I don't think either of us grew up with, where it was still kind of like an option, where back in the 90s or the early 2000s, where it was like, yeah, you can use this technology, but you know, you could also just go play outside. And now with this new generation coming up, it's like they've never had that, and there are some effects and of that, and they might be quite drastic, or they might snap out of it. You know, once they start to mature, maybe they'll find this other world that we grew up with, and be outside of it, but maybe not. And then now you add AI into the mix and you say, okay, now I can just create this image, but there was no struggle to it. You know, there's no like to actually go and create that image 5 years ago, like you needed to struggle with all of these different methods and everything like that. Now I go on ChatGPT and I create an image and all of a sudden it's there and there, but so that might reflect some challenges in terms of kind of the mass of people, in terms of like, well, what do people do now? And those questions are probably gonna, you know, people have talked, we're not the first people to talk about this, but they're like, those questions may become really, really relevant. Yeah.
Stuart, the thing, right, when you said that, you know, you and I grew up in the Bay Area, and I remember when I was a teacher early in my career, I taught at one of the schools I taught at, it was like the number one school in the country at the time. A bunch of their parents were Silicon Valley executives, and they had such limited austere screen time because their parents knew exactly what they were designed for, and they had the strongest, strictest guardrails around it, right? And contrast that to my experience in low-income schools, some of the worst districts in the county, And yeah, no guardrails at all. Hey, just use it, be free, right? And so what I would be really keen to see is how are the AI executives, the people who know how it works, the people who know how easy it is and how much it streamlines and all the things, how are they going to let their children leverage it?
Yeah, interesting.
I'd be interested to see.
Do you think there's any way? So there's a really interesting thing what you said, because you have both experiences, and I want to talk about AI training an AI versus training a human being. I want to talk about that later too. But and this next question may get into that. Like, what is, we have an immune system inside of our bodies, and we have an immune system reaction where we, where certain things that aren't good for us, our body learns to adapt to those things and reject them through all these various ways that I don't understand. What is the sort of meme immune system or cultural immune system to the thing that you just mentioned about like kids inside of low-income areas? Is there any way that we can change that? Because I believe that the last 10 years of development of technology in terms of mobile phones and highly addictive kind of patterns around technology, I don't think that's going to go into the future. I'm actually really optimistic that we'll be able to figure out ways to have technology in a healthy way in the long term. But I think in the short term, it's actually really challenging. But is there any way, like from your experience of teaching inside of those schools, is there anything that you saw that was sort of like that gave you optimism about a better relationship with technology, particularly in parts of society that don't have the sort of kind of the executive level kind of thinking to avoid the negative sides?
That's a great question. So I would say, I used to teach in an inclusive classroom. So students with different neurological needs, and technology was crucial. Right, like, hey, if a student had trouble reading or experienced dyslexia, like, hey, here's this like speech to text to speech app, or vice versa. I used to work at an edtech company that gave voice feedback, right, for students to, like give them a different modality to take in information, to receive feedback and whatnot. So I like, it is very important, and it really helps bridge the gap. And then the other part that I mentioned earlier, there was this kind of framework that I used to abide by. It's called the SAMR model, where how do you use technology to either substitute, augment, modify, or redefine the
Ooh.
assignment, right? So for example, hey, let's say there's a prompt. You could have a kid like use technology to substitute what you're currently doing. Hey, just write it on a, instead of writing pen and paper, write it on a Word doc. Substitute. Hey, augment it. Okay, maybe put a voiceover. Hey, modify it. Maybe add some level that you could not normally do. Let's say you host a podcast, right? Like that one prompt changes, like can change with technology and totally revamp what you're being asked to do that may be more relevant to society or what their needs are, or what have you, or what a job in the future might entail. So in those ways, I love the use of technology, especially for those in lower income neighborhoods, right? So like, yeah, again, same Chromebook, except my assignment to them was, hey, the challenge was, hey, host a podcast on this topic, find the guest and do that, write your questions out. That's a different topic than, hey, write a boring five paragraph essay that you're never gonna really need because this is in the future. And so what I learned is that when you're in lower income neighborhoods, you have teachers and principals, educators, or whatnot that are, let's say, hey, you want to teach to the test to secure funding, and you're fighting over attendance, and you're doing all these things, and you're worried about the fundamentals. So where is your bandwidth to come up with these creative lesson plans? Ask these kids higher level questions when you're trying to deal with like truancy or late tardiness and all this behavioral issues. And so those are some of the ways that I could see it being beneficial. And then it's like, okay, so if you do let AI go in an area where the fundamentals aren't addressed, what are you going to do? It's going to be likely just used in a substitutionary way, in a cut corner way, which is like, okay, that works, but it's not the most helpful.
Very cool. Okay, so can you spell that model? I'm really interested.
SAMR, it's just SAMR.
Okay.
Like a substitution, augmented modification, and redefinition of a task.
Beautiful. Okay, I'm gonna go look into that. SAMR model. That's really interesting. I'm down here in Argentina, and I'm there's political changes going on right now, and those political changes, a large percentage of the population is on a monthly welfare check, basically, and so about 40% of the population is dependent on it, and that's going to go away in about a year. And so everybody knows that, and so there's sort of like this really intense pressure to do something. And it's really challenging because of those things that you just mentioned there's no foundation. There's no foundation for a lot of these people to actually compete inside of this crazy world that we're entering where AI is coming in. And so I've been trying to think about how to actually help that, because what I see with AI is just like the playing field is going to get leveled. Like for me, coding, I've been teaching myself how to code. I am now doing things with these tools that I am just totally mind blown by. And so like, that's me as a non-technical person very quickly getting the thing to teach me. And so the use case that destroys all the other use cases for my personal understanding is that AI as a tutor, like AI as a tutor is far, far more impactful than any of the other business use cases that I explored at Invisible for me personally. And so, but I have a tendency to teach myself things. And I know that that's not a shared among the entire population, but I'm sure there's a way that we can actually like structure society to use this tool as a tool and help people to learn better, but it's so unclear. Well, this will be fun now to go into this. What do you think are the, well, do you have any ideas for how we can use this technology to improve education, given your background? And then as a secondary question later on that we can go into is like, what are the similarities and what are the differences between teaching a human being and teaching an AI?
Yeah, great question. You know, I'll be honest with you. I haven't thought really deeply around AI policy and education. I do follow some people who are kind of at the forefront there and are carving themselves out to be thought leaders. But yeah, candidly, I haven't thought too deeply about it. I would just say that policy always lags behind, right? Whatever is happening in the market, right? And so like the fact that we don't see it, it's like, yeah, because not enough things have gone wrong, or there's not enough widespread awareness, and there's not enough use case or examples. And so like, where am I at with that? All we have right now are hypotheses, and I don't have a well-formulated one. Yep. Yeah, absolutely eager to see. I think the school in general, like, I'm always interested, the parts of the school areas that I'm really interested in that I would keep a tab on if people are interested, I would look at schools like Synthesis. I would look at the micro school movement. I would look at schools like that, and you know, who's sending their kids there? Like Elon Musk looked at the schools and said, "Hey, these schools suck. I'm going to make Synthesis or Ad Astra. Great." Or all the tech people in Austin, for example, in Austin, Texas. "Hey, schools here suck. I'm going to build a bunch of micro schools." Okay, so see what this is. What I mean by this. See what the people who are at the forefront of technology are doing. See how they're making their decisions. They're not making decisions like normal people. And because they have resources, they are making their own schools, or they're enlisting them to really wealthy schools that are at the forefront and doing things that they know are going to be allow their children to command high dollars in the future. So that's where I would see. And then if that's good for them, then I would say, why isn't, because here's my, I will bet money that the things that are happening in the best schools and the most privileged schools are not going to be widespread policy, because it's not in anyone's best interest for the mass populace to have all of those, because it's always about the competitive advantage. Why would you give everyone the competitive advantage? It's not going to happen. That's my pessimistic take.
it's pessimistic according to the way that things have worked for the last 300 years, I would put it. Maybe actually longer than that, because what you're talking about is deep competition. But I feel like the rules of the game are about to change.
This is, I'll say this is my proxy. Let's look at what are two things that are really healthy and helpful for everyone. I think any adult would say, and this is a critique on public education that's happened for a long time. Hey, how come I was never taught to balance a checkbook, apply for a job, do my taxes, take out an auto loan, or learn about like bubble compound interest? Okay, well, why? Well, great question. If we've known about that for hundreds of years, look at how many states have financial literacy inside their education policy. Sure. Next to none.
Yeah.
I think Georgia came up with, was the first one like 3 years ago. Cool. Why is it that after hundreds of years, Georgia was the first state to do that 3 years ago? That's interesting. Or here's another one you should ask ourselves. Nutrition. Hey, we all know that nutrition is really important. I'm like a big biohacking guy. I do take a lot of like little supplement, all these things. And I'm fascinated. I'm like, why have I not learned any of this? Why have I looked at the back of a cereal at a pyramid to look about how I should eat? How come schools have never taught me about that? I actually thought maybe there's some cultural sensitivity, you know, maybe there's like, hey, you know, like y'all don't know about Korean food or all these things. And maybe that's the thing. But I also thought like, well, who's like, where is their skin in the game to help everyone be healthy and financially literate? And whose best interest is it not in, right? And so with AI, hey, this is good for everyone. Okay, it could be like the other things I mentioned. Well, where's the policy that is actually going to help everyone? I just can't see that happening, considering the state that the powers that be are right now. That's just my humble opinion.
It's very interesting. I came into the same question oftentimes. I was a yoga teacher for a long time, and I would teach people breathing exercises, and they were like, oh, why has nobody taught me how to breathe before? And it's like so simple. It's like, the answer that I came to is because nobody knows how to breathe. But we do know how to breathe, but we don't know how to breathe correctly, but there is no correct. And a lot of the breathing exercises are kind of silly, but I love this question, and I really want to go deeper dive maybe we could ask this now, like who are those people in the AI policy world, policy versus education, and we can go over it afterwards too, but I would love to start doing interviews about education policy. And like, it's so interesting that question you just asked of like, why is no one focusing on financial literacy? And there's no good answers apparently. Well, why do you think? Like you kind of talked about it already, but do you know anything about that Georgia thing? Why Georgia eventually implemented it?
I actually don't know. Well, when I was in grad school, I went to Harvard Grad School of Education. I studied education policy and management. At the time, I wanted to stay in education or whatever, right? And my first startup was on a financial literacy startup. Right. And it was a model after what I did in every classroom. I instituted a economic system into my classroom.
Oh, cool.
Because my mentor at the time, he invented it back in the 80s. His name was Bill Jarvis. And it was like I employed every kid. They all had a job. They all got paid. We had Chun bucks. They had to pay rent for their desks. They could also own their desks. We had auctions so that people could have a thing to spend, but I'd, you know, make an auction to control for inflation because that would always happen. We would tax people, like students just voted on like welfare systems. Students came up with like, hey, like insurance companies, and like, hey, if you pay me a Chun buck a week, like we'll cover all of the fines that you incur from Mr. Chun and like blah, blah, blah. And it was fascinating, right? Here's my favorite use case here for the Chun bucks thing was, and they came up with the name, by the way, I'm not that narcissistic. I am, but not that narcissistic. Was bathroom was always an issue, middle school, right? And so I just said, hey, like go, I said, hey, in real life, one, don't ever ask anyone to go to the bathroom. Like go to the bathroom, right? I've never, when the hell do I ever ask to go to the bathroom as a grown man? If I don't have to do it, you don't do it. But I will say, just pay me a dollar a minute that you go. Go, like whenever you want, just go. Yeah. Like, honestly, they wouldn't even have to raise their hand. Just give the person at the door who keeps track of the minutes to charge you. Don't even ask me, and they'd go. I never had a bathroom issue. ever. Like if kids went, they ran to the bathroom, ran back. I'm not, but I mean, what was I trying to say is like, hey, if you leave class, it's valuable. Knowledge is power. Hey, you know what?
Yeah,
but just
yeah,
go or just go at a reasonable time, like before class or between breaks. Right. But yeah, anyway, we did that. And so I wanted to say, hey, like, was there a startup idea here behind this?
Yeah.
Could I scale this, build it into a product or whatnot? And then when I was building into like, oh, okay, what's my TAM? Like, what can I address? Like, what standards can I hit? And I'm doing this research. I was like, holy crap. No one is talking about financial literacy. There's like Everfine. There's like a few people who are doing things, but
yeah,
by and large, they're not. And then well, honestly, it got a little too depressing and I just didn't dig into it any further because yeah.
Is that why there's just no money in it? There's no money in the education.
I mean, listen, this is like
speculation. Yeah.
Cue the speculation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Cue my get your tinfoil hats on, everybody.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right. But like, okay, what, like who lobbies who?
Yes.
Like, where is national standards?
Yeah, got
who
it.
lobbies
Yeah,
national
yeah,
standards, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Who's best interested is it in for that? Hey, all of the working class, all the blue collar, all these folks know how to get out of poverty and know how to not be just an employee, but know how to invest or become an entrepreneur or start up an idea or like raise money and all these things. No, like why? Hey, I want to keep that privileged information to my privileged children to perpetuate my privileged like lineage, right? Like that's just my paranoid tinfoil hat theory, based off absolutely no facts. But like I think about human intentions, right? Like what's the human disposition here? Like you want to protect your own. And if I knew better and I, you know, like I could see people voting or making decisions that way.
And so this leads into kind of the what I've been thinking a lot over the past couple years is this sort of we're in a world last 300 to 400 years have been large nation states with large bureaucracies and large policy kind of things that are all sort of like interacting in these ways. Like for example, my roof collapsed in my home in California, and then I had to get I got insurance to pay for it. And the process of going through this insurance with this giant machine that is just basically the only goal it has is not to get sued. That's the only goal that it has. It doesn't matter what I care about. It doesn't matter what my contractor cares about, but it's this just giant machine and it's not working. It's collapsing. It feels like from my understanding, these things are sort of collapsing, but they're not collapsing in a sort of like apocalypse way or anything like that, but they are collapsing in terms of their ability to do anything besides not get sued. And so these things, and like, this relates to those policy and the lobbying thing, because those things are all sort of symptoms of this thing. And that's all related to sort of technology that we had previously about the industrial age and large factories and large businesses. And it feels like a lot of that's going to change really quickly. This is what I meant by the rules of the game are starting to change as well. Do you agree with that? Do you disagree with that? And if you do agree or disagree with this sort of like that we're entering a new world where things are going to get a lot more decentralized, a lot more small groups are going to be able to have a larger effect. What's your take on this whole thing?
Yeah, I would say I don't think I have the strongest, like, well-informed opinion, but I do have like, oh, like, yeah, certainly I see the times changing. Certainly I see like, yeah, I mean, we're talking about decentralized currency.
Yeah.
I mean, just if you think about what some of these things means symbolically, it's absolutely insane, right? And I don't mean that in like a insane bad way, but it is like absolutely paradigm shifting. Like, could I see the whole world being very differently from where we are now? Like think about every institution that we held sacred is now being challenged. Yeah, from currency to government to institution of higher education to accessibility of at almost every level. And yeah, and then you have the technological means to actually level the playing field, right? With like really strong hypotheses around it. And then you have like these early adopting governments and countries and like, right, like proving it out. Right. And then you actually start seeing in some ways like these being reflected in the market, which is almost the most important thing. Yeah, it is. It's remarkable, right? Like I'll give a few examples. Hey, you can buy a Tesla with cryptocurrency. That was wild. Hey, like a big tech company saying, I don't require a college degree to command a multi-six-figure salary. Hey, for like, I don't know, El Salvador or whatever to accept like cryptocurrency as like actual tender, right? That, all of those things, it's all early. They're all, but what is it like? It's like any startup or any business. Okay, great. Early use case. Hey, you have a big logo. Hey, what have you? But is it still early? Or is the ROI or the use case going to be widely acceptable?
Yeah.
And like, is there going to be in some ways like product market fit in that way? Do we have product market fit? I don't think so. I think people are still using the dollar. People like got rid of their Dogecoin, right? There are things that like people like have done. But like, does that mean we're never going to have that? I don't think so. But yeah, but I would just say right now, it's like, I don't really have like a strong bet. All I know is it's like, okay, let's hold, I'm holding it with a lot of curiosity and just like, you know what? Larger institutions have been disrupted by far less in human history, from monarchies to kingdoms or what have you, like what we thought were like wild, right? Like are now like antiques, museums, and history lessons. So yeah, like, do I think like the way we have it is like it, and it can never be disrupted? Like, absolutely not. But is it right now, next 10 years, next 100? Kind of TBD for me.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it's wise too, because it's like getting it early is just as bad as getting it too late, basically.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we don't know, you know, we like, and this is the strange thing, maybe you share it from growing up in the Bay Area, is that the Bay Area was, and maybe continues to be, of the future. So that if you were just in the Bay Area, you were already aware of the things that would only affect New York 10 years later, or 5 years later, or anything like that. Now it seems like it doesn't matter that much if you're in the Bay Area. Like if you're in New York, if you're in the Bay Area, you probably are getting aware of a lot of these things. And then that process is going to go only increase. Yeah, but that led to a sort of technological optimism that is just like, oh, you guys don't get it. You're not from here, so you don't get it. But then now it's all changing. But that also leads to overestimating when things would actually happen.
Yeah,
which definitely happened a lot.
Yeah,
yeah. Cool. Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. How can people find out more about you and what you're working on?
I would just direct them to my LinkedIn, Albert-S.Chun, Chun.
Cool. Thank you. Thank you, Albert.
Of course. Thanks.
Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this episode. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Stuart Alsop III. Also, don't forget to subscribe on Spotify or iTunes for every weekly episode that I publish on Monday mornings. Hope you have a great day.